Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jack Schreiber, and I'm the interim pastor of this wonderful church. And on behalf of this congregation, may I wish you a very warm welcome to our meeting tonight. I had the privilege... Thank you. I had the privilege 3 years ago of traveling to Palestine with a group called Keep Hope Alive. And we planted olive trees in Palestine. It was a magnificent experience for all of us. And for me, it was an eye-opener as to what exactly was going on in Palestine. Like most Americans, I think, at least many, I had no idea what was happening in that country and how the Palestinians were being treated. So when this opportunity came around, this was something that I and the congregation really wanted to do. So we are delighted to have you here this evening and to host this event. That having been said, there may be things tonight that you and I would perhaps maybe disagree with. And if that's the case, then you'll have an opportunity to share at the end of the time, and that will be explained to you a little bit later, to ask questions or make a statement. The thing that I would like to ask you very humbly is to respect this holy space. This is our sanctuary. This is where we follow the Prince of Peace. And I would ask you that you would respect this holy place. And even more importantly, we are all children of God, loved of God, and the way that we can honor God tonight is by honoring one another and respecting one another. So I trust that you will do that. I know that this time together will be educational, and I trust that it will also be inspirational. God bless you all, and again, welcome.
Hi, and I'm Barbara from the Middle East Children's Alliance. And Jack, thank you so much for welcoming us here in your church and standing up for justice. Thank you so much. The Middle East Children's Alliance is one of three different organizations that have been supporting this tour, which has gone around to many cities around the United States. And we're very happy to have been working with IJAM and American Muslims for Palestine. And we're looking forward tonight to hearing from you, Heil. We're so grateful that you're here with us in this country and that you're going to speak tonight. I wanted to just quickly tell you about two events, and then we're going to move along. On Saturday, February 26th, our associate director, Ziad Abbas, is giving a half-day workshop in San Francisco with IJAN and Rethinking Schools. It's called Teaching Palestine, and it'll be at the Women's Building on 18th Street in San Francisco from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. And this workshop is for youth educators who want to teach about Palestine in a way that is useful and empowering. For more information, please check out our website, meccaforpeace.org. And on International Women's Day, March 8th, we're thrilled to be bringing the wonderful Palestinian negotiator and analyst Diana Boutu to Berkeley for a Mecca benefit. She'll be speaking on uprisings in the Arab world and what's behind the negotiations. Also performing that night will be poet activist Maria Poblete. And this will be at the First Presbyterian Church, First Congregational Church at Channing and Dana in Berkeley. And you can get more information on our website. And I want to thank everybody who worked so hard to bring this tonight to you. And forgive us for having little problems here, but you know, every once in a while you make a mistake, but you know, it's okay. And finally, I just want to announce an evening with Mazen Kumzia on Sunday, April 3rd, 7 o'clock at the First Congregational Church at 2501 Harrison Street. It's at 27th. If you want more information, I'm not going to read it all. You can call us at Mecca. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce a friend of mine, a young friend of mine. Of course, when you're almost 70, everybody is young. But somebody who has really, I think, has really impressed me for stepping out and speaking out in the way she has done on this issue. You know, it's not easy to stand up and speak out as an anti-Zionist Jew, but nobody does it better than Sarah Kirshner. Please welcome her.
So, good evening. It's great to see so many people out tonight. It's such a cold night, and I think you will not be disappointed. It's a real privilege to be able to hear both Dr. Bazian and Dr. Haya Meir. This stop is the 12th stop on our tour, and last night we had an incredible event in Sacramento at the Salam Center. 300 people came out to hear Dr. Bazian and Hayo speak. In other parts of the country, we have done this event not only with people and organizations from Jewish, Christian, and Muslim faiths, but also from Palestinian, Jewish, African American, Native American, and Roma communities, as well as gay and lesbian activists and people with disabilities. And across all of our communities, what we share in common are long legacies of survival to genocide and also resistance. What is also true across all of our faiths and communities is that for the long histories and beliefs and ethics that are grounded in our collective humanity and in liberation are also those who exploit our faiths, our political beliefs, and our ethics to oppress or to brutalize others. And the basic message of this tour is really just that. It's that any of our histories of genocide and dehumanization make dehumanization and genocide possible against all of us. And that struck a nerve with a lot of people. The other part of our message is that any of our histories of genocide, and certainly for us as anti-Zionist Jews, the history of Jewish persecution and the Nazi genocide cannot and does not justify the persecution of Palestinians, the targeting of Arabs, Muslims, South Asian, West Asian, Central Asian, or Southeast Asian communities here or anywhere. And that is the message that gets the kind of response that we have outside. The ADL has issued press releases. Stand With Us issued their very typical, truly hateful propaganda. But really, I think that means that this message of common humanity is one that they're at odds with. And that means that they're at odds with the great majority of people on the planet. So the sponsors of this tour have a few very simple messages in addition to our common humanity and the necessity and obligation to stand when anyone's being targeted. And one is that while we do share common histories of survival and resistance, of struggles for liberation, we also have very unique histories. And so while there are some parallels and some patterns that will be discussed tonight between particularly the history of the Nazi genocide, the current experiences in Palestine, and between the anti-Semitism of fascist Europe and the Islamophobia of present-day United States and Europe, we are in no way calling those the same experiences or comparing them. It's important to the actual experience of those histories that they be kept and held specifically as they were and in the specific history that they happened in or current day time that they're happening in. This tour has happened at a really important time. I mean, we did live through the fall of apartheid in South Africa, which, though there was a 30-year struggle for, was still amazing to see fall. And with what's happening in Egypt and what's happening in Tunisia, and we're starting to see in Jordan, in Palestine, in so many places in the region, we're seeing a leadership and a demand for freedom and dignity that is not only so important to what we're talking about tonight, but it's also so important to our struggles here, because it's a reminder that we are, in fact, it is, in fact, the people that are going to rise up and going to demand freedom, and that we're going to do that collectively. In Egypt, with the Georgia prison strike, you saw people across class, ethnicity, race, gender, sexuality. You saw people come together across great difference to demand that freedom and dignity. So before I introduce our two speakers and invite them up onto the pulpit, I wanted to read a quote by Israeli academic Yehuda Elkana, who said that from Auschwitz symbolically came two peoples, a minority that proclaims this will never happen again, and a scared and anxious majority who proclaims that this will never happen again to us. Tonight we are here and able to hear from someone who is of the minority. And it's a real honor for us to be able to bring on stage Dr. Chaya Meyer and Hatem Bazian. Please come up. Speaker tonight will be Dr. Hatem Bazian, and for those, hopefully many of you have heard him speak. For those of you who have not heard Dr. Bazian speak, it is going to be a real treat. I have rarely heard someone who can connect so many dots, hearing you speak in New Orleans to communities there about the connections between the African-American struggle and the Palestinian and Arab-American struggle, also connecting the dots between U.S. relationship with Israel, Zionism, and then what's happening with Islamophobia in this country. Dr. Bazian has a long history of anti-racist struggle, anti-war activism, work on disability rights, and is generally a fighter for humanity and human rights. So please join us in welcoming Dr. Bazian.
Good evening, and thank you, Sarah, for the introduction. And hopefully I'll try to connect as many dots I could find. And those dots need to be connected. My talk today is going to go in the U.S. about Palestine, specifically the entanglement of American discourses on Islamophobia with Palestine. And I am focusing on this specifically to show that many of the forces that are working on demonizing Arabs and Muslims in this country and their production of Islamophobia is squarely coming out from the pro-Israel infrastructure in this country. And once I go through my talk, you'll understand why this is the strategy that they pursued, and then why is it important for us to counter and structurally respond to it. Now, first to give a definition of Islamophobia, Islamophobia is an organizing principle employed to rationalize and extend the dominant global power structure and silencing the collective global other. It actually says who belongs to the civilized world and the criterion for membership, and who is the demonized and ostracized global other. Rationalization for the existing domestic and global economic power hierarchies and militarism, and to provide for continuation of the military-industrial complex-based economy. Our economy is a military-industrial-based economy, and that's why all these discussions in Washington, D.C. about budget cuts is not even touching anything of the meat of the military-industrial complex. We have almost $775 billion military budget. This is excluding Iraq expenditure, excluding the Afghanistan expenditure, excluding all the supplementary expenditure. And if you add the past 40 years of servicing the debt that was acquired during the Reagan era to expand the military, literally our budget is heavily vested in the military-industrial complex, and so far we have not begun to challenge the basic pillar of our economy. So Islamophobia is about, once again, constructing a new enemy. So once again, we create more smart bombs that will be used by dumb people that can't throw these dumb bombs, while we're starving our healthcare, starving our education, laying off people, and really removing the safety net across our own society. Islamophobia reintroduces and reaffirms existing global racial structure. Arabs and Muslims are the racialized in the current period. So when you speak about Arabs and Muslims, now they are a racialized group. All the structure of racism that was applicable toward African American, Latinos, Asian, and minorities in general is applicable to Arabs and Muslims. This does not mean that racism toward those groups has ended. It's actually continued. It's a standard operating procedure in terms of racism. And one indication of what, when we speak about racism, if you look at our prison system, we have 2 million prisoners. The overwhelming majority of the prisoners are African Americans and Latinos, and you have a better chance if you're an African American to go on death row than anything else, and we have more in prisons than at Yale. And that should be an indication for us of why racism is still part of our structure. Islamophobia also about control of resources. When we speak about the threat of the Muslim world, because we want to sit on the oil. And it's interestingly enough, we have racism. We don't like, quote-unquote, dark-skinned people, but in the Middle East, we like something that is dark called oil, right? It's an interest contradiction, right? So our investment in the creation of Islamophobia is about controlling oil resources and driving all those oil resources toward us. Islamophobia is also about supporting dictators so as to prevent the Islamic terrorism, i.e. we have to support dictators because the alternative is the boogeyman. Interestingly enough, as soon as the people in Egypt rose up, the same talking heads from the neoconservatives, from the pro-Israel forces, are all covering the media talking about the boogeyman. In Israel itself, the Israelis preferred the dictator. The last phone call that Mubarak made was actually to the Israeli leaders complaining that America did not stand with him till the last minute. Now, when did America stand with its own employees that were dictators? Every time that a dictator we employed for a long period of time, when his service is over, meaning that people are realizing he is problematic, we move to the next person. What interests are served by Islamophobia? Pro-Israel forces in the US and Europe. Right-wing forces in Western societies, military-industrial complex, right-wing Christian groups, and Arab authoritarian regimes. So they all are benefiting from promoting and engaging in Islamophobia. Now, why Islamophobia? And this is important for us to understand, because this is the constructed argument that is being made to get people to join on the bandwagon of being Islamophobes. Daniel Pipes, he's one of the foremost Islamophobes, and I'll mention others, Stephen Emerson. Speaking before the convention of the American Jewish Congress on October 21, 2001, Daniel Pipes said the following: I worry very much from the Jewish point of view that the presence and increased stature and affluence and enfranchisement of American Muslims will present two dangers to American Jews. And let me repeat this. I worry very much from the Jewish point of view that the presence and increased stature and affluence and enfranchisement of American Muslims will present true dangers to American Jews. Meaning that the fact that you have Arabs and Muslims in here because we could speak of them too. And the fact that they're present in our country, that they're beginning to participate politically, they're part of civil society, they're increasing in terms of their resources, that is seen as a true danger for American Jews. But I think in here, for American Zionists who wants to maintain the United States strictly in the side of Israel, and therefore he sees this as a danger because Pipes and others want to have the arena exclusive to themselves. They don't want a debate, they don't want a discussion. That's why every time you want to discuss Palestine, they want to shut the discussion, because if there is no debate, there is no possibility for people to think, does Israel serve our national interest? We could debate our nationals, but does Israel serve our national interest? Why are we dumping so much money and resources in Israel? Those questions, if there is no speaking, no discussions, no open debates, then silence will not produce any change. And that's why every time, whether it's a lecture in campus, whether it's a lecture in the community, whether it's in a church or a community center, you'll find those who actually are anti-debate want to shut down the debate. They don't want to debate the issue. And therefore, one part of the strategy is to silence and to try to push the Arabs and Muslims, as well as those who are in support, to the margins. Also, M.J. Rosenberg, who formerly worked for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, recently wrote that the right-wing Zionists opposing the community center in New York, you know, what came to be known as Ground Zero Mosque, which was not at Ground Zero, nor was it a mosque, but even if it was at a mosque or at the Ground Zero, it should not be a problem. Right? That terminology of Ground Zero Mosque was actually coined by Pamela Geller, who is a 24/7 advocate for Israel. And in 2007, they held a conference or a meeting in Europe with some of the most racist segments of Europe to actually strategize of how to deal with the rising tide of Muslims in Europe and the United States. And that's why Stop the Islamization of Europe organization, they brought and created Stop the Islamization of America. M.J. Rosenberg says the following. He says, those who are advocating on Islamophobia, they believe that the more acceptance there is of Muslims here at home, the less reflexive hatred there will be for Muslims abroad. And that, in their view, reduces America's sympathies for Israel. Let me give you the exact understanding. They believe that the more acceptance there is of Muslims here at home, the less reflexive hatred, meaning they want to produce reflexive hatred toward Arabs and Muslims. So when we bomb Arabs and Muslims in there, we don't feel that we're bombing or killing or destroying or invading legitimate human family that are like us. And therefore, we need to produce this reflexive hatred. So when Americans hear Arabs and Muslims say, oh, they don't belong to the human family, they are less than human, subhuman. Furthermore, he says, to stoke Islamophobia and national security concerns will boost the GOP in the midterm elections. Interestingly enough, I compared the Chinese Exclusionary Act period, where we had a rising sentiment against Chinese in America. It was led in California by the Democratic Party. So in here, the Democrats don't have as clean record as you are. Even we elected Obama, it does not mean that they have a clean record. In California, it was the Democratic Party that was leading the effort against the Chinese. And they constructed all kinds of argument to create the hatred and discrimination against the Chinese. So we have a similar strategy. In the past election, we have deploying Islamophobia as a way to win elections. And we saw it in a number of districts around the country. Now, the real concern for Israeli supporters in this country are the following. How to keep the U.S. firmly behind Israel policy? Now, you should know that Israel policy, even to those who just would look at them, they really have no support in reality other than the one that is often manufactured by AIPAC with its continued pressure on these politicians to try to maintain their stand behind Israel. Also, Israel has no peaceful or military solutions for its own made problems. The two-state solution, it is Israel that prevented the two-state solution from taking place. It's not the Palestinians. It's not the Palestinians who are occupying themselves. It is Israel that occupying the 1967. It is Israel who moved 500,000 settlers into the West Bank. It is Israel that increased settlements and settler activity by 300% during the peace process. It is Israel military that is occupying and is actually in Palestinian land. And therefore, if you look at it, the two-state solution with the bypass roads that they have set up all over the place, have eaten most of the West Bank. And therefore now they say, well, we don't have a peace partner. The papers that were released by Al Jazeera showed that even Saeb Erekat was ready to give everything, including his mother, and the Israelis did not accept. He offered everything. He offered refugees will not come back. Accepted all the settlements except one settlement. Accepted to negotiate over all aspects of Jerusalem, including allowing the Israelis to have a say on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Yet the Israelis said, we are not going to discuss this issue because the Israelis, with their Zionist attitude, they want maximum land with minimum Palestinians. Maximum land with minimum Palestinians. They still think that transfer is the best approach to undertake. And that's why Lieberman, the foreign minister, he's always entertaining the idea of saying there is a Palestinian state, it's called Jordan, they should go there. This is the foreign minister, the current foreign minister of Israel, just a recent immigrant from Russia, who until arriving and setting shop in Palestine was a bouncer, right? And all of a sudden he's telling the Palestinians that they need to go and leave and to live in Jordan. Third, increasing Palestine activities in North America and Europe that is beginning to make a difference in some places. And we need to realize this, including our presence in here. An increasing split among Jewish Americans on the question of Israel and its occupation, settlements, and treatment of the Palestinians. There is a split in the Jewish American community. And I think IJAN, Mecca, and other organizations, even if you look at J Street, creating a new lobby group, even though we could say, some say that they're APAC-like, nevertheless, the fact that you have a split in there proves that there isn't a consensus among Jewish Americans on the question of Palestine. And that for many of those pro-Israeli that are to the right wing, if not jump over the cliff in terms of their political view, that is a real concern. Lastly, an increasing split among American elites who see Israel as a continued source of difficulty in relations to U.S. policy in the Arab and Muslim world. And therefore, you don't have a consensus, and that is a real concern for a state that is heavily dependent on U.S. economic, military, political, diplomatic support for it to maintain its unconditional existence in a belligerent status relative to the Palestinians and all its neighbors. Now, look what Olmert, the most outspoken of Likud leaders and until recently was Israel Prime Minister. Look what is his concern in relations to the Palestinian and the crisis that he's coming ahead. He says, there is no place for two states between the Jordan and the sea. Now, how many of you often hear the Palestinians don't recognize Israel? All right? And yesterday in Sacramento, somebody, you know, put that question, do you recognize the state of Israel? Here's the prime minister saying, there is no place for two states between the Jordan and the sea. Had a Palestinian said this, he would be on 24/7 on Fox. You see, they want to throw Israel to the sea. You see, they don't have any peace. They can't be trusted. Right? Said, there is no place for two states between Jordan and the sea. All we want is the right to vote. The day they get it, we will lose everything. Meaning he's even fearful that we might have one state where one man, one vote for all the citizens or all those who are living in historical Palestine. That, from Olmert's perspective, is a major threat. Further, I shudder to think that liberal Jewish organizations that shouldered the burden of the struggle against apartheid in South Africa will lead the struggle against us. So he's worried about liberal Jews beginning to actually realign themselves with the ethics of Judaism and the ethical perspective that historically been in the forefront of political struggles with progressive forces. He's worried that that, once again, will lead the struggle in here in alliance with other forces, Arab, Muslims, Palestinians, Buddhists, and so on, that will bring about change. Now, we have to understand the perspective that has constantly been there in relations to the Zionists. Joseph Weitz, he says, between ourselves, it must be clear that there is no room for both peoples together in this country. We shall not achieve our goal if the Arabs are in this small country. There is no other way than to transfer the Arabs from here to neighboring countries. All of them. Not one village, not one tribe should be left. This is the guy from the Jewish Agency's colonization department. I often say that this is not a person who's just standing next to 7-Eleven talking out of his head of what he thinks should be done. This is a person that is responsible at the highest level of government, just like the statement before that you saw from Netanyahu at the highest level of government. Another, from 1972, it is the duty of Israeli leaders to explain to public opinion clearly, courageously, a certain number of facts that are forgotten with time. The first of these is that there is no Zionism, colonization, or Jewish state without the eviction of the Arabs and the expropriation of their land. So again, continued argument of not wanting the Palestinians there. Now here's our beloved Bibi Netanyahu, current prime minister. Now, he said Israel should have exploited the repression of the demonstration in China when world attention focused on that country to carry out mass deportations among the Arabs of the territories. That should have taken the opportunity of the demonstrations in Tiananmen Square to carry out mass deportation. Now, can you imagine, if I change the language a little bit, Syria should have exploited the repression of the demonstration in China when world attention focused on that country to carry out mass expulsion among the Jews of that of their country. What would be the response? All right? So in here, at the highest level of the Israeli government, you have individuals that still believe that the way to solve, quote-unquote, their problem is by transferring the Palestinians. And this is at the highest level of government, not somebody, once again, going to the side of the street, talking by themselves in 7-Eleven and talking and saying, here's what we should do. This is at the highest level of the Israeli government. Rafael Itan, chief of staff, he says, we declare openly that the Arabs have no right to settle in even 1 centimeter of Eretz Israel. Force is all they do or even will understand. We shall use the ultimate force until the Palestinians come calling to us on all fours, meaning like animals. So again, it is the chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Force that are making these statements. Now, there is Martin Buber, a Jewish philosopher. He says, we will have to face the reality that Israel is neither innocent nor redemptive, and that in its creation and expansion, we as Jews have caused what we historically have suffered, a refugee population in the diaspora. All right? So this is once again reflecting ethical outlook and ethical perspective. Now, going back to Islamophobia. In the U.S., there are many people that are making the argument against the argument relative to the internment, to rationalize that the internment was something that was good in the 1940s against the Japanese, because they want to make the argument that it should be directed toward Arabs and Muslims in the current period. Michelle Melkin's book, In Defense of Internment, now just the fact that you actually have a book that is distributed and you go to some of the stores, right? You actually could see it in Barnes & Noble on the shelf. The fact that you have a book on the shelf with that title should indicate for you the level of discourse that have taken. In Defense of Internment, the Case for Racial Profiling in World War II and the War on Terror. Said the most damaging legacy of the Apologia and Compensation Package has been its impact on national security. He says the ethnic grievance industry, so she's calling the Japanese American, she's calling the African Americans who fought for civil rights, she's speaking about the civil rights movement, this is the grievance industry. And these are the civil liberties chicken littles. It's interesting, just this past few months back, we celebrated in California Fred Korematsu's Day. Fred Korematsu challenged the internment decision, took it to the Supreme Court. He lost at the Supreme Court, which shows you that law is born out of social conditions. The social conditions at the time made internment among the elite and among the even those who deal with the law something that is acceptable. And so we always have to be aware what is taking place in here is preparing public opinion. So if a case like this occurs, even those who engage in the legal process can see the internment as something that is acceptable. So it's important for us to understand this process that is occurring. Now, Daniel Pipes once again comes in and makes supporting the argument for the internment. He wrote in an article about Japanese internment, why it was a good idea, and the lessons it offers us today. So he actually feels that there's lessons from the internment. And he goes, he says that he believes that the government authorities should direct special attention toward Muslims living in America, either by registering their whereabouts, profiling them, monitoring their mosques, or infiltrating their organizations. All right, that's Daniel Pipes is not a person also speaking that he was appointed by George Bush to be on the peace commission. The U.S. Peace Commission. I would like to see what would be the person we appoint on the War Commission if this is what we have at the Peace Commission. Oh, we know we have Rumsfeld in there, and we know what he did, right? You go to war with the troops that you have. Right? So basically, he's arguing that internment should be used against Arabs and Muslims in this country because, once again, if you remembered his early quote, he's worried about the increasing enfranchisement of Arabs and Muslims in this country from his point of view of how to keep the United States firmly in the side of Israel. And then at the end of this quote, he said, this lobby, meaning the grievance lobby, has established that it resulted solely from a combination of wartime history and racial prejudice. His argument is that the Japanese internment was actually based on sound national security grounds. Every researcher of repute around this country who looked at the Japanese internment have proven time and time again that the reason for the internment had nothing to do with national security. Furthermore, the research that was done is actually the monitoring of Japanese began as early as 1930, almost 10 years prior to the war, because there were already feeling of hostilities toward Japan and hostilities in relations to U.S. position vis-a-vis Japan. So by extension, the Japanese-Americans, who possibly some are second and third generation here as Americans, by extension must be responsible and must have a fifth column attitude in this country. And in here what we have, somebody just beginning to put out this information to rationalize the internment. The 2008 presidential election, we saw the entry of Islamophobia into the debate by the pro-Israel forces. The Endowment for Middle East Truth, what a term. It should be the Endowment for Middle East Untruth, but once again, that's the name that we have to deal with. The Clarion Fund, they share the same New York address with Aish HaTorah, which is a Israeli group. Their view is that the threat of radical Islam is the same as that posed by Nazi Germany. So they can compare Nazi Germany at any time they want, and therefore that's what they're comparing. Ari Morgenson from EMET organized and oversaw the distribution of Obsession, which is a major documentary. He is actually a former press officer for the Israeli embassy in D.C. Talk about trying to even enter at the U.S. presidential election to influence the election in 2008. This documentary, Obsession, 28 million copies were distributed around the country. This was a free DVD. It was inserted in 70 major U.S. newspapers around the country in the swing states where Obama was possibly either winning or losing. It cost about $16 million to do so. Right? Building on that Obama is somehow is a closet Muslim, which is still about 23% of the American public believe that he's a closet Muslim, 43% believe he's not Christian. If you add those up, the overwhelming majority of our own American public that listen to some type of news either believe he's Muslim or not Christian. So you add up the figure and you wonder what type of information they read. This is without touching on the birther's rights movement that still believe that he was not born in this country. Obsession documentary was funded by the Clarion Fund, which is had a decisive look pro-Israel outlook. And then followed this is another documentary, The Third Jihad, which has been promoted heavily at Fox News. The Third Jihad is saying the following, that this is actually speak about some of the earlier radical Islam. This is says that the current Arab and Muslims in America, they're not radical in the notion of Muslims that you see with big robes and turbans and so on. These are individuals that wear suits and ties, and therefore they're undermining us from inside. They got four congressmen to try to call a hearing to investigate Muslim interns who work on the congressional level as congressional interns. And next week you're going to have a hearing that was organized by Peter King that wants to bring Muslim leaders to say what is their role in radicalizing Muslims around the mosque. This once again is being motivated, being supported by some of the major Islamophobes that are decisively coming from the pro-Israel production capacity, with the understanding of trying to push the Arab and Muslim population to the side in civil discourse in this country. A third documentary also that they put together is Relentless. So you have a whole production team with millions of dollars behind it that is structured to demonize Arabs and Muslims, and you will find why. I'm going to go a little bit. I know that we're getting time. Now, Israel ruled during the Cold War. Israel have defined itself to be Cold War strategic ally for the U.S., regional power in the Middle East, protect Western interests, keep balance of power, provide valuable intelligence, test and develop weapons. That's the role that Israel played during the Cold War. In post-Cold War and post-Iranian Revolution, Israel recast its role to counter and prevent Islamic extremists and Arab nationalists. So Israel, if you actually look at APAC's material, you will find that most of it is focusing that Israel is basically trying to prevent Islamic extremists and Arab nationalists. Second, reasserts its strategic value in a unipolar world, that Israel is our strategic value in there, that you could trust us, you could depend on us. Speak of common threat with the West. So every time that they, if you look at Israel speak in terms of their public relations, they use the same language and replicated the same language, so it's like we have the threat, so the Palestine conflict becomes part of Israel speak in relations to the war on terrorism. Provide training and know-how as a subcontractor. Many of us don't know this. Every major police department in the United States, their chief of police and some of the officers are sent to Israel to get training on how to counter terrorism. Israel has built a whole town, Arab town, with also mosque-looking buildings to train U.S. police forces and U.S. military on how to deal with terrorism. And what do you think a police officer who comes from Oakland goes to there and come back? What type of attitude and whom would we think that a terrorist look like? Therefore, it's a structural way of also shaping our own domestic discourse relative to terrorism. Further expand its foreign policy reach so as to become more viable. India, China, sub-Saharan Africa, through this current period, and become the go-to experts on countering Islamic ideologies and movements. Every time you open the TV, most often the spokespeople that you find on TV today that is speaking about Islam, the Muslim world, Islamic terrorism and so on, are all affiliated with the Islamophobia Production Network, which essentially is an Israeli pro-Israeli network in this country. Who is producing Islamophobia in the U.S.? Pro-Israel activists have been the major contributors to the financing, production, distribution, and usage of Islamophobia in the American context. While other forces are present and do deploy Islamophobia in the U.S., nevertheless, the pro-Israel activists have set up the structural backbone of the Islamophobia operation in the United States. Their goal, singular goal, is how to keep U.S. unconditional support for Israel in a unipolar world. Their goal is how to keep U.S. unconditional support for Israel in a unipolar world. And their resources are all directed at this. Now, institutions behind Islamophobia. These are the institutions that produce Islamophobia. You have Jihad Watch, Robert Spencer. Once again, he's funded by the same network of funders that fund all these, and it is a major pro-Zionist network, in particular this multi-millionaire Chernik and his wife, $750 million worth of resources that they fund many of these organizations. Campus Watch, set up by Daniel Pipes, that monitor every faculty or every professor, And sometimes, in the early period, they would pay $100 for students who would actually would report on their faculty. So you'll have a student who actually, which is a travesty, you have a student that actually pays a tuition to learn, he's actually going to be paid $100 to sit in the class and just write what the professor said and file it to some other group like Campus Watch. Not only are you wasting the person's time, but essentially setting up a whole network where the relationship between the student and the faculty is completely tarnished, and you're no longer actually building or educating. You're it's almost like being in a Kafka-like structure. American Freedom Defense Initiative, Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Center for Security Studies, Middle East Forum, Middle East Media and Research Institute, Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, Freedom Center, Center for Security Policy, Pajama Media, ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, and I always leave the A out, Defamation League, because it's much more appropriate, because they 24/7 are defaming the Arabs and Muslims and putting all kinds of materials that target and speaks of Arabs and Muslims. GCRC, Jewish Community Relations Council, they actually write reports which are hit pieces directed at community. I have my own report that they actually gave to San Francisco State University president as a confidential report, which details all what they claim to be anti-Semitic actions or activities, which often was pro-Palestinian speeches and activities, and they asked the university to take action. And similarly, they put a 5-page hit piece when the Democratic Party's meeting in San Francisco took place. They had a 5-page hit piece that specifically was targeting me and distributed to all the attendees of 500 attendees. That was the work of GCNC, the American Jewish Committee, likewise. Seaman Wiesenthal, I think Sarah is going to talk about it later on. Stop the Islamization of America, it's another organization, it's Pamela Geller. Investigative Project on Terrorism, I want you to pay attention to this outfit. This outfit is run by Stephen Emerson. Stephen Emerson is one of the most vehement anti-Islamophobe in this country. He is the one that jumped immediately after the Oklahoma bombing and said that this have the hallmark and touches of Middle East terrorism. Maximum death, right? Maximum casualty. He is the first to produce a documentary on jihad in America. He also have systematically provided reports. Recently, he's been issuing and providing these reports about major Muslim leaders to prepare for Congressman Peter King's hearing. So Stephen Emerson, he's often brought as an expert, right, on the Middle East. He should be an Israeli spokesperson in America, and we need to always identify him as such. And his role is to demonize and to basically make any person that he writes about with his material to be almost radioactive. It's almost to create a problem and to be untouchable. So when you go and give a lecture at the university, he will send with all his operatives all this information, so the university will be fearful, we don't want to have this lecture. Or like a lecture in here, you have received most likely a statement from the local community. Stephen Emerson was quoted by the group of rabbis in Sacramento. They took a quote from his book on jihad in America, which quote me, saying a statement in 1999 in a conference in Santa Clara. The conference never happened, nor the organization he referred ever had a conference in 1999. Before that, they said that that statement was attributed to me in 1996. Anytime that you see attribution of a year without date, place, and a specific title of a conference, you know that it's a fabrication, because that's the same thing that happened in the Palestinians in 1948. It says that the Palestinians left Palestine because the Arab leaders called on them to leave, because the Arab leaders are going to bring their army and throw the Jews to the sea. You'll see it replicated in almost every major Zionist writing on saying why the right of return and the Palestinians are to be blamed. So far, they have not been able to produce a single evidence, not a single evidence of any radio broadcast inside Palestine or outside of Palestine. Front Page Magazine, and the list goes on. There's about 18 outfits that are all supported by major contribution. And what you need to understand, they are all also connected through the internet. They cite each other and they connect their inter- internet searches. So when you search for a name, you immediately get a whole bunch of negative pieces on any individual that is identified with pro-Palestinians. The names of the individual, David Horowitz, Stephen Emerson, and the rest of them. Now, the 2010 elections, we have a number of candidates that used Islamophobia. So Islamophobia has been monetized. Once again, mobilized into the election by pro-Israel spokespeople and advocates in this country. What are the goals of the Islamophobia campaign? Demonize Muslims. Demonize Islam and Muslims. Thus, Muslims who believe in Islam are guilty. Criminalize Islam through link to terrorism. Isolate Muslims in American society. Marginalize Muslims in civil society. This would lead to further radicalization among the youth. Radicalization in some cases leads to violence. Violence must be responded to by further security and military measures. So it's actually a structural way to cause some of the youth to even go in violence, and thus Stephen Emerson said, you see, I told you these are violent and we need to deal with them, thus rationalizing the security structure. Response to Islamophobia, and I will be ending with this, make information known and educate people. You need to make this information known about who's producing Islamophobia and what is the purpose behind it. You need to make that link and you need to be explicit about it. Expose and challenge those who produce and promote Islamophobia, including protesting businesses owned by the Islamophobes. If a business that is supporting Islamophobes and donating money to produce this Islamophobia, we need to protest their businesses, just like Martin Luther King protested the racists who were not hiring African Americans and were racist, because racists and those who use racism should not have a free ride and they need to be challenged. Develop coalitions that challenge racism across the board. So while we're speaking about Islamophobia, we have to have coalitions across the board to speak about any community that is facing racism. We need to build coalitions, become more active in all areas of civil society, write a blog, develop a source of information on the internet, and link it to others as well. You need to write, you need to link, you need to be active in there. And then finally, donate and support financially. This effort, as well as others, cannot succeed without your resources, so make sure that you provide the resources that are needed. Thank you, and hopefully you'll have some questions.
An incredible amount of information in limited time. Thank you. So, note cards, some of you got note cards in the beginning, and we're going to take questions on note cards. If you did not, they're coming down the aisles now, and they'll be collected just before Hayo finishes speaking. I had intended to do this in the beginning and then got flustered by technology. So there's a lot of people we need to thank. I wanted to first thank Reverend Shriver for your... I know you have a very long history of taking unpopular stands or stances that are unpopular to the wrong people, but it's really incredible, the work you do. Thank you. And I need to thank Penny Rosenwasser. I don't know where Penny is. Are you here? Is she here? In the back, who did an amazing amount of work on this event, as did Toby Kramer, who is coming down the aisle in this vest, and Rachel West. So thank you. We have an incredible team of volunteers here tonight, and I just want to run through our endorsers, which is worth an applause. The Arab Resource and Organizing Center, the Barbara R. Ruskin Scholarship Fund, the Bay Area Coalition to End Israeli Apartheid, Catalyst, California Coalition of Women Prisoners, Code Pink, Critical Resistance, Free Palestine Movement, Global Women's Exchange, Haiti Action Committee, International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five, International Solidarity Movement, Northern California, Jewish Voice for Peace, Rossmore, Justice for Palestinians, San Jose, Keep Hope Alive, Bay Area Presbyterians, Oakland Interfaith Gospel Choir, Poor Magazine, Priority African Network, San Jose Peace and Justice Center, South Alameda Country, Peace and Justice, two more, the Palestine Children's Welfare Fund and Women in Black Bay Area. So thank you to all of our endorsers. For as many nerves as it touched, it also really resonates with a lot of people from many struggles. Before I introduce Hayo, at the end of Dr. Bazian's talk, he talked about different actions we can take, and he mentioned the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And education is an important piece, and political discussion and consciousness is an important piece, but action and our campaigns and demands are equally important. The Simon Wiesenthal Center, how many people here are familiar with the Simon Wiesenthal Center? Okay, perhaps more than most of our audiences. So the Simon Wiesenthal Center is a center that was founded after Simon Wiesenthal, obviously, and he is someone who spent his life tracking down Nazis and bringing them to different international courts. And in his name, several centers and museums of tolerance have been established. Or what they call museums of tolerance. And when we were in New York City, we went with Hayo and also Hedy Epstein, who's a refugee of Nazi Germany, to the Simon Wiesenthal Center in New York City. We requested a meeting. They didn't grant us one, and so we showed up for an impromptu visit and then demanded a hearing with the director of education, and she obliged us. The Simon Wiesenthal Center, some of you will know because of their stance against an Islamic cultural center in Lower Manhattan. They wrote articles that equated the entire and diverse Muslim communities of New York with the people who drove planes, the extremists who drove planes into the Twin Towers. And they came out with statements that included the kind of stereotypes that they would bring people to court if not get them incarcerated for. They are also building their next Museum of Tolerance on an ancient Palestinian cemetery in Jerusalem. Many of you have heard of it. It's the Mamilla Cemetery. And this is particularly cynical, given that desecration of Jewish cemeteries is one of the highest, crimes within Judaism, and that the Simon Wiesenthal Center has, you know, spent a lot of energy around the desecration of Jewish cemeteries in Europe. But they also, when we went for a visit, the so-called Museum of Tolerance did have incredibly powerful educational material about all kinds of racism, homophobia, disability, sexism, also had documentation of displaced peoples, refugees, mass transports, different kinds of home demolitions, and not once was Palestine mentioned. But perhaps even more enraging than that was that at the end of this very powerful educational program, they show a video in which about a third of the video and a third of the images and the only images of Muslims in the entire museum are of Muslims as terrorists. And it's as if to say that the tolerance for other communities depends on our intolerance for this community. And it was such a manipulation. And while we were there, we saw hundreds of school children going through just on that one day. So we're passing around a petition, and we're asking you to join us in demanding that the Simon Wiesenthal Center change its educational material, stop building a quote-unquote Museum of Tolerance on a Palestinian cemetery, and issue an apology to the Islamic Cultural Center in Lower Manhattan. So that's coming around now. And then just one other thank you, which is this tour has taken a month, and the other co-coordinator of the tour and co-founder of IJAN is with us, and that's Mish Levy over here. So please join me in thanking Mish.